I'm Kelly Cervantes, and this is Seizing Life. Susan Axelrod is the founder of Citizens United for Research in Epilepsy, my mentor and dear friend. She's going to roll her eyes at me saying this, but in the epilepsy world, Susan Axelrod is a living legend. Around a kitchen table much like this one, Susan created CURE with other epilepsy moms. This grassroots organization blossomed over the next 20 years into the leading organization for epilepsy research. During that time, CURE has raised over $60 million and funded more than 220 research grants in 15 countries around the world. Talk about being a super mom. CURE has also been responsible for shining a light on SUDEP and infantile spasms, which were sorely ignored prior to CURE's efforts. Susan and I first met during one of Adelaide's hospital stays when she came to visit us in the hospital. I will never forget the compassion and emotion in her eyes as she saw my infant daughter all hooked up, just as her daughter Lauren had been 36 years earlier. Susan, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Kelly. You know, as I've said to you before and to so many other new moms, I've loved getting to know you. I love what you're doing and your energy and your passion, but I so wish we weren't in this club together.
Amen.
Yeah.
So I know you have told this story 1,000 times, and I'm going to make you tell it 1,001. Your Lauren was diagnosed at 7 months old, which coincidentally is the exact same age Adelaide was when she was diagnosed. Take us back to that day.
Yeah, so Lauren was our firstborn child. She was, everything was going according to plan. Talk about seizing life. We had dates, we had expectations. I was in graduate school. I was going to complete my education. Had a baby, took 3 months off, started back to school, and as you said, when she was 7 months old, she was perfect. She was, by all measurements that I could make, she was developing fine, mm-hmm. She was beautiful, she was happy, she was friendly, all those great things.
All of which she still is, I might add.
True. But she, one night I put her to bed. She actually had a cold. And she had not slept for a couple nights, and my pediatrician said, give her a quarter of an adult dose of a cold medication, and maybe she'll sleep. I had an exam the next day. All I needed to do was sleep, and I put her to bed, and she slept through the night, which was actually unusual for her because she was usually still getting up once or twice a night. And so in the morning, I had to get going. I had to get to class. I go in the room, and I see that she's lying in bed. She's gray. I swoop her up. I think that she's passed away. She is totally limp, and then goes into a seizure. Well, I, like many of us, had never actually witnessed a seizure before. Didn't know what was going on. Knew it was not normal, but again, she's my first born, and I'm thinking, well, maybe, I don't know, like one arm went up, her eyes rolled back in her head, she frothed at the mouth, and so I actually called my mom. I said, this is what she's doing, and she said, emergency room. I went, okay, so I get into gear, take my baby to the emergency room. I'm sitting waiting to be seen, and she has another one of these episodes. They then inform me this is a seizure. They whisk her off and do untold things like spinal taps and all sorts of things. And I'm sitting there and I'm waiting, and they come back in and they say, we need to hospitalize her. She continued to have seizures. I think it was very clear at that point she'd had seizures all throughout the night, that first night. And that first hospitalization, it was actually January. It was super cold. My husband will talk about walking back and forth to the hospital every day after work. I stayed with her. As you know, you don't ever leave a baby unattended in the hospital. She just seized relentlessly. We were hospitalized for a month, and when they sent us home, she was still having about six seizures a day.
Which is crazy to think about, because the same thing happened with Adelaide. We never got seizure control. They sent us home and she's still having seizures. Yeah. And this is your first introduction to this. And you think, like, but how can you send us home? This isn't fixed. Right. And you realize there's just no answers.
Yeah. And in my day and age, she was the epilepsy word, the E word, the big bad E word, was never brought up.
Well, and you've mentioned that to me before. Yeah. So what did they tell you, and when did you first realize that it was epilepsy?
Yeah, so she was diagnosed with an idiopathic seizure disorder. And I literally did not know for the first 3 years that I was dealing with epilepsy. Again, pre-internet, long time ago.
Right.
I saw a report on an EEG, and it said something about epileptiform activity in the background.
Right.
And I panicked, and I called her neurologist. I thought we now had a dual diagnosis, idiopathic seizure disorder and epilepsy. And he sort of chuckled at me. We were friends at the time, but he said, no, they're the same. We just didn't use that word before.
I mean, it's mind-blowing.
I know.
That Lauren was three before you realized that.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I didn't have an internet to sort of look up idiopathic seizure disorder, find out that it's one and the same with epilepsy and that, you know.
Yeah.
So at any rate, we brought her home. Her development, you know, she had been at that point crawling, babbling a bit. She was always a little bit quiet, but babbling a bit. And at this point, she could barely sit up in her high chair.
Right.
Medications, impact of, you know, by then, I don't know how many seizures. Thousands of seizures.
Sure.
And we had, when we were outpatient, they suggested that we try using Valium, so benzodiazepine. So we introduced that to her regimen. We put her on the Valium, and the seizures stopped. And we were like, oh my God, we're done. We've cured her. So, you know, she wasn't in great shape in terms of her motor skills had deteriorated, but 3 months later, the seizures returned, and they returned with a vengeance. Mm-hmm. And that sort of was the pattern that we then got into for the next 18 years.
Sort of a honeymoon period where the drug will work, and then it just stops.
And then they get resistance.
The brain finds a way to work around
it. Yeah, the seizures, damn seizures, are pretty persistent. So, you know, we we'd start calendaring it and sort of saying, oh, you know, we're at the point, you know, we'd get 3 months was about as much as we ever got. One time we got 11 months and thought, oh my God, this is amazing. And then she broke through again. So for the first many years of her life, we were hospitalized every single time. And again, you know, I would go in, or my husband could spell me a little bit, but we never left her alone because, first of all, for her emotional well-being, but secondly, every time we did, something happened.
Right.
You know, wrong medications, whatever. It was, you know, just too scary to leave her. So consequently, her two younger brothers were left at home with caregivers, with neighbors, whoever we could sort of drum up, because the one thing we all know about epilepsy is it's not predictable. So you don't know what day you're going to have to rush off to the hospital.
So you are in and out of the hospital trying to figure this out, trying to find control. And you finally did get control when Lauren was 18 years old. How?
She was in really, really bad shape. And she had been put on a number of different medications. Again, we were treating her at home. But at this point, her doctor said, and her doctor, who knew her well, said, I think you got to bring her in. We've got to get an IV going. And it was the only time I think he has ever looked at me, and I just looked at his eyes, and he said, I'm not sure what else we can do. And I thought, this is it, because she was just seizing.
Yeah.
And he'd added everything that he felt was safe to add. And but Keppra had just come on the market. Now, I had just started Cure, and so knew that this was something in the pipeline. Just become acquainted with some of the people at UCB who manufacture the drug. And that had been our lives. Whatever new drug was available, whatever study drug we could get on, stick around that. And so I called somebody that I had come to know at UCB, and I said, when can I get it? And she said, oh my God, I'm FedExing you some samples tonight. Got them, gave them to Lauren, and those were her last seizures.
Wow.
Amazing. So those seizures that brought her into the hospital were the last seizures we've witnessed. And that was now 18 years ago. And she, I mean, I don't know how or why. I wish that we knew why that drug worked. That's one of the goals of research.
And you don't have a diagnosis for her.
We don't have a diagnosis.
You don't know what was ever causing her seizures. So there's just no way to know.
Yeah.
It's no wonder that you started CURE. But you are the mother of three children. You have a special needs child. Your husband is traveling a ton. How, in the midst of all of that, are you like, okay, I'm going to start my own nonprofit, and not just like, I'm going to fundraise, and you know, this is you're funding research. This is a lot of work. Mm-hmm. This isn't just going out and throwing fundraisers. You're raising money, and then you're finding research projects and grants. And I mean, this is no small feat in the midst of all of this. Yeah. Where was it born
from? You know, it was born from the desperation that we all feel, those of us whose kids have not responded to medications and whose lives are being just, you know, destroyed, if not lost. And it came from slowly, again, talking about my age and how long ago this was, but slowly meeting other moms.
Yeah.
The power of moms. One of the physicians that was on our board when we first started used to say, there's nothing like an angry mom. And I used to say, we're not angry. We are desperate.
Yeah.
There's a difference.
There's a big difference.
You know, I started to meet these other moms, and we started to do some fundraising for support groups and things like that. Mm-hmm. And then really started talking and learning that I thought Lauren was the only one out there who didn't respond to medications. I honestly did. I thought epilepsy's certainly been cured and solved by now, and I just have this fluky child. You know, fast forward to meeting some moms, and I'm like, no, there's a lot of us.
Yeah.
There's a lot of us.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's a spectrum. There's some who, you know, as who lose their lives. There's some who can function fairly well. There's some Lauren sort of maybe in the middle there. I mean, so the impact is very variable, but we're all struggling and we all want more for our kids.
So how do you get, though, from moms around a kitchen table to actually funding research? That there's a lot of work that has to be done in between. You were not scientists. You can fundraise, but that there's a big difference between fundraising and choosing grants and getting the grants submitted. So how did you get from point A to point B?
I have been known to say, like, people have said, well, what was your business plan? I said, there wasn't one. This was just, you know, we started, and I think one of the most remarkable things that's happened is that we had so many friends who watched our lives and watched our lives with Lauren and wanted to do something. And friends that had skills and talents and expertise in certain areas, not in science, not in epilepsy, certainly, but were just absolutely, they just felt so frustrated because there was nothing they could do. And so initially, one of those friends connected us with our attorney who drew up our first incorporation papers.
And all pro bono.
All pro bono. So that was a tremendous step.
Wow.
I mean, you know, so doing that, getting us registered as a nonprofit. And subsequently, I mean, we've had all sorts of people, you know, just donate strategic planning, donate marketing research, donate event planning. I mean, you name it. And it is a way for people, and I would encourage everybody out there, we all know somebody who can help.
Yeah.
It's not always about dollars, but those gifts have enabled us to put the dollars we raise
gifts
more directly into research.
Right.
you know, of course we hoped it would help our own children, but the hope was it would lead toward better understanding of the disease and better treatments, preventions, and cures.
Well, I think that's sort of my next question is, what were those early goals? What were you, you know, you wanted to move the ball forward, but what, you know, what did you think was going to come out of it? Where did you see it going?
I'm sure that all of us that were involved in the initial founding of the organization had different expectations, but mine really were, I had maybe given up hope for Lauren. Here, maybe I was a little pissed off that nobody was looking at this disease and what caused it. And it was just sort of this acceptance.
There was no other organization like this out there that was doing this research.
That's right. There wasn't a voice out there saying, my kid, I mean, I really thought I was alone. There were no people. We know that a third, that's an estimate, but a third of patients are intractable. So where are those people? Where are those voices? And so...
And now we can find them on social media.
Right.
We can, you know, work, you know, there's this other connectivity, but you didn't have Google, you didn't have a Facebook social group to find those parents. So I, you know,
And I will say one of the most amazing things to me, apart from the moms, and the dads that, that I've met, is relationships developed. And I don't think we can speak enough about this, but between parents and family members and researchers and clinicians. And that was a very unexpected benefit, but I think it is, I think it has really sort of made a cohesive community. And I think that for the doctors, they were sort of operating in this vacuum without their cheerleaders, without people saying, this is the most important work. You're working on these rats, you're making them have seizures, you're trying to develop things. But nobody's saying, go, go, go.
Right.
So it sort of kind of leads me into my next question. I know you fairly well at this point, and you are a bit of a perfectionist. So I know the fact that you've been at this for 20 years and we still don't have a cure for epilepsy, is it sits heavy on you. That's hard. But Cure has accomplished so much. The epilepsy community and awareness, the research being done, is so much further along than it was 20 years ago. Where are those changes? Where do you see that growth? What has changed in our community over the 20 years?
First of all, I think it's very clear we've made progress in genetic discoveries.
Absolutely.
That needs to take us to the next step of the, you know, being able to diagnose and then tell.
That sort of precision.
What is
medicine.
That precision medicine, personalized medicine? What is going on? Which is, that's the core of what, you know, what we wanted to accomplish in some ways, really. And that, you know, there are new discoveries, you know, all the time in the genetics of epilepsy. So I want that to start leading now to better treatments and answers for the kids. I mean, my heart's with the kids, but we really, the research that we do will hopefully help everybody.
Sure.
No matter what their age, when the onset of epilepsy, because we know that can begin at any age. And so I think that's, you know, that's a scientific progress that can't be denied, that is definitely going forward. And that really sort of reinforces this, my core belief, which is we need to understand the why to develop rational and more effective treatments that don't just obliterate our kids' brains. And so I think that's really important. I think we have gotten the word out there a lot more that people are struggling. People are suffering. Epilepsy is not a sexy disease. It hasn't had the public persona of all these other diseases. And so we've really had to fight for our space within neurology. It's one of the most common diseases. And yet the budget certainly didn't reflect that. And so I think we've made progress in that. We've certainly opened up the field of sudden unexplained death in epilepsy.
SUDEP.
Which was, SUDEP, which was never, ever even talked about. Doctors didn't talk to their patients about it. And really thanks to, you know, one of my heroes, my personal heroes, Gene Donnelly, whose son Christopher passed away from SUDEP. She called the NIH and they didn't know anything about it. So she really spearheaded this whole program, which is now taken off. And, it, you know, I think as a relatively small research organization, I know we're the leading research organization.
Which says something in and of itself.
Yeah.
You know.
I mean, we've worked our tails off. And if you compare our budget to that for other diseases that affect even fewer people and maybe affect them later in life, it's still paltry. You know, we really need to do much better with that. But we have opened up a lot of fields. You know, in addition to SUDEP, that we have focused on is infantile spasms, in part because that is, as you well know, a potentially really devastating diagnosis. But also, one of the things we've tried to do is carve new paths in the way research is done in epilepsy. And a lot of other fields, we're doing team science. So with our infantile spasms program, we invested in a group of researchers who had to. We forced them to come face-to-face and work together on this problem. So basic researchers, clinicians, and really tried to facilitate communication and, you know, so this is working in your rat. How is this working in your babies? And really get that
moving. It's mind-boggling to me that science doesn't do that already, that researchers, like the how proprietary they are over their research and how it's just not for the greater good. Yeah. So I think I think those are two aspects that that Cure has found these needs and shined this bright spotlight so that other organizations kind of come in and take that and then Cure can move on to the next thing. Right. But also this idea of enforcing that team science. Mm-hmm. It's just, I think Cure has done so much for our community and for science and research in general. What is there anything in particular that you are the most proud of?
One of the things that we have really loved doing is funding young investigators.
Right.
We rely on all the people that are established in the field, but they have done tremendous support to us in helping to review grants and helping to select the best work. Mm-hmm. But bringing these young people in, and then when you see some of the areas that they say, because we pride ourselves in being the risk takers. Within reason, but we want to invest in new ideas and simultaneously build the pipeline of researchers for the next generation. So some of these individuals have just had tremendous success, and it's opened up just new fields and new ways of looking at epilepsy, which I think is critical. And they can't do that with government funds.
No.
This is a critical space for an organization like Cure.
Yeah. Solid return on their money.
Yeah.
Cure can take those risks.
And we have to sort of tell people we're willing to do that. Along with that, we also have to expect that there could be failures. I mean, that adds to our body of knowledge. And so
it's not lost on me how parallel our stories are. And also that I am 1 year younger than Lauren. And how that has sort of impacted our friendship. And I see the work that you have done, and I am just always in awe of you. So to that point, taking your lead, where do you want to see Cure go? Where do you want to see the epilepsy community push forward? Where do you want us to be 20 years from now?
Out of business.
Yes.
Could we do that, please?
I'll second that.
Yeah, I think I'll still be on the planet at that point, and I'd like to just say, hey, I'll be there for the celebration. I mean, I think that we are on the cusp, maybe another 5 to 10 years of being able, as we know, epilepsy is many, many diseases.
Yes.
So we can't say we're going to cure it all. But let's start tackling them. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'd like to see happening. And that's, one of the reasons we've sort of approached infantile spasms or SUDEP is let's zero in on this, or prevention of epilepsy after head injury.
Mm-hmm.
This is a known risk factor. These are known things. Let's get smart here and sort of figure out how we can tackle this. Break it into pieces.
Stop it before it happens.
Right.
Exactly. Or know exactly what treatment is going to work for that specific
Exactly.
epilepsy.
Exactly. More funds are desperately needed, and I don't want anybody to think that that's not the case. However, I do want to make sure that it's focused. I mean, I think our impact has been really significant, and there are other people and hopefully pharmaceutical companies, et cetera, that will be interested in development of therapies. But if we can lay the groundwork for them and be really smart about what we're doing, and I just want to get to the point on my way over here this morning, or actually before I left this morning to come here, I opened up my email and there was another email from somebody asking, baby just newly diagnosed. And as it was hard for me to walk over and see you in Adelaide that very first time, my heart breaks, you know, it's an infant.
Yeah.
It just shouldn't be happening. So yeah. I want to see that number greatly diminished.
That
it may be unrealistic 60%
that doesn't know why. I think, you know, yeah. To your point, we've got to make yes. a dent in that number.
Yeah, and I want to see, I mean, I think the community that you're building with this podcast and your work and bringing people who are, yes, younger than my daughter, into it as support. I mean, because we didn't have that. So we found each other just by happenstance. But it's huge what can happen.
Yeah.
The power. So
there's power in numbers. Mm-hmm. Susan, thank you so much for talking with me, for being a friend and a mentor. And we are all indebted to you.
I'm all in. So thank you for what you're doing. Appreciate it.
Adore you.
Okay, me too.
For the fundraising, advocacy, and research Susan has contributed over the last 20 years, a simple thank you fails to suffice. To me, she will always be a symbol of hope that through research, a cure can be found. But as Susan has stated, in spite of all of her efforts, so much more remains to be done. If, like me, you cling to hope for a cure, then we need your help, and that can be as simple as staying informed. You can learn more about the research being done by CURE and our community by visiting seizinglife.com/research. Finally, don't forget to visit and follow at Seizing Life Podcast on Facebook and Instagram and at Seizing Life Pod on Twitter. Thank you so much for listening today.
The opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the views of CURE. The information contained herein is provided for general information only and does not offer medical advice or recommendations. Individuals should not rely on this information as a substitute for consultations with qualified healthcare professionals who are familiar with individual medical conditions and needs. CURE strongly recommends that care and treatment decisions related to epilepsy and any other medical condition be made in consultation with a patient's physician or other qualified healthcare professionals who are familiar with the individual's specific health situation.